Today I want to talk about something which is, I feel, really significantly important. I think for all of us at one point or another, I know it's important for me and has really seriously been important for a long time, but I didn't really understand it until recently. I understood it because of watching somebody else going through the same thing, and all of a sudden it clicked on me that many of us have the same problem. So I'm talking about the situation of feeling suffocated. Now, it's not only that you are suffocated like in the movies when somebody takes a pillow and sticks it over your head and you're struggling and you want to die, you're going to die because this criminal wants you dead. This is not the only way in which you can be suffocated. There are various forms of suffocation. There are various ways in which a person can experience a feeling that they can't breathe, or they can't move, or they can't live. We have seen that these feelings of suffocation can appear even in childhood. Sometimes children feel suffocated by their parents. They feel suffocated because parents are overly protective, overly restrictive. I once told you about this funny movie, Shirley MacLaine was in it, where this mother was so hysterical about the security of her daughter that in the middle of the night she used to go and wake her up and ask, "Are you alive? Are you still breathing?" Now, I know this is funny, and it was actually amusing in the movie, but after a while you began to understand that we can be so crazy sometimes about our care and protection and love that it becomes something else. Have you ever heard the term smother you in love, or smother one with love? I don't know if you would have that in Russian. It means that you are so, your love is so kind of overwhelming that the person who is feeling the love becomes smothered, becomes, they can't breathe, they can't live because of all this so-called love. Now, if you were to see love like that, it could be seen in one sense as a, not really as love, but as kind of a sickness, or as something which would so transform your energy field as to be an imposition in your life. We can think of smothering, this concept of being smothered, as an enormous imposition. It's an enormous challenge to us, where we have to deal with two things simultaneously that seem to be, or the one of them anyway, this love that comes at us seems to be very good or desirable. And then at the same time, this being smothered by that love, being restricted by that love. Whereas, for example, parents are so afraid that something would happen to you that they don't let you do anything. So you become so conflicted, you become compromised, because you have on one hand this love, and you know it's something okay, you know that the love of parents are good, and then at the same time you feel so compromised by it, so restricted by it, because it's keeping you from developing yourself. It's keeping you from expressing yourself. It's keeping you from developing your own process of individuation, that process which assists all of us in our growth as individuals so that we can live, that we can stand on our own two feet. Now that is a phenomena which is quite contrary to the animal kingdom. If you look at the way animals bring up their young, you will see that the animals, they so dedicatedly allow their small children to feed, to be protected. The mother will even give up the life for the protection of these children. The mother is totally 100% devoted to these children with no other activity involved. Simply that they should eat, they should sleep, they should feel secure and protected. But then at one point, it's practically written in the DNA of all the animals. The mother says, okay, now you go out on your own. Even sometimes the children don't want to go. And the mother pushes them out. Now you go. And there's no connection again after that. A complete detachment. As if the function of the mother was to simply raise these children to the point where they can stand on their own two feet and then push them to do so. What's even more interesting is in many cases the father's function is simply to impregnate the mother and nothing more than that. In some animal species, the father will also be there to assist in the protection. That's more, I would suppose, the exception than the rule. I don't know exactly. Now, of course, that is not to say that this model should be used by humans, because humans have many more difficulties in their lives than animals. We have this complex social structure. Animals, of course, also have a social structure. They have older ones, stronger ones, louder ones, female ones, male one, hierarchy even amongst different animals. They know exactly the order of things, and if they step out of line, they're immediately put back into line and balance is restored in the social order. Human beings are much more complex. Human beings have this capacity of not saying something sometimes, of holding within themselves grudges, of feeling bitter, of seeking revenge, of thinking badly, sometimes about themselves, thinking about themselves as guilty or as the cause of a situation or somehow responsible for it. And there's so much to know because we human beings pride ourselves in manipulating our environment, in conquering our environment, of transforming our environment. So we human beings have an enormously expanded social framework. We have an enormously expanded economic framework. Our political arrangement organizes our society with extremely complex rules. If you look at the most organized of all non-human civilizations, you'll find amongst the ants, for instance, or bees, these incredibly organized civilizations where the entire colony works as if they are one individual. They function with every single unit doing exactly what it's supposed to do, doing exactly it the way it's supposed to do it. It's just a phenomenal framework. Yet it's very simple. exactly what is to be done to get the food, bring it to the queen or to the colony, and just go back and forth all day. It's very simple. Of course, I don't know the nuances of ants, but I would assume any other duties are also extremely straightforward. Maybe there's some displays of enormous selflessness, but it's also somewhat straightforward. Human beings also have selflessness. Human beings also have the capacity to work in the group. But it's very complex. The whole thing about humans is complex. Therefore, to prepare children to deal with this complexity requires much, much more than in an animal kingdom. Therefore, parents keep their children until they are educated, not only at home, not only by their relatives, but by schools, by colleges, by alternative forms of activities, sports or relaxation or music or arts or whatever, to expand their horizons, so that when the children leave home, they are best equipped to deal with the world. Yet, we still find that even in this very nice, supportive, and protective environment, some children feel suffocated. Some children feel that they are not able to live in this environment. Some children feel that they are being diverted from that which they are as individuals into a path dictated to by others. Sometimes these children can't wait to leave home, or even while they are there, rebel against that which has been created by their parents by acting in ways which are contrary to what the parents said, even sometimes purposefully contrary, simply because they felt suffocated by their parents. We have seen this time and time again. It seems to be a pattern. This also happens amongst relationships of husbands and wives. This also happens in relationships between friends, among schoolmates. We find that we can boil down a lot of what happens in our lives to these types of experiences. For example, if you have been trying this EFT, and we also now have for our Harry Media members this EFT videos available in flash format for viewing on the web, but you will see that, for instance, if you have like a certain kind of a fear, you're afraid of doing something. Let's say you're afraid of public speaking. Now, you might be doing that EFT and you might be saying, you know, I'm trying to deal here and conquer my fear of public speaking. But there's always something behind it. There's always something behind this fear. If we go back just for a second to suffocation, what is behind our feeling suffocated is this need of the one who is suffocating us to express their love in terms of this enormous energy of protection. In other words, I'm going to now prove that I love you by being your guard, by being your guardian, by being your guide, by making sure nothing bad happens to you. Why does that person do that? There can be many reasons, but there's always behind this, whenever somebody feels suffocated, there's always behind it a mentality in a person why they do it. Let's go for a second back to this aspect of fear. Why we are afraid, for example, of public speaking. Why do we, not all of us, I mean, I don't have this to the extreme. I thirst sometimes on it. It's just like something I drink. That's something else. There's more to that than just simply not having fear. It's like, you know, I want to express. This is my whole thing. I'm an expresser. That's something else. That's another kind of a quote-unquote challenge to deal with. But let's say somebody has a fear of public speaking. And this fear can be so enormous that they practically are paralyzed at the thought of having to speak in front of others. Now, if you analyze it, the act of speaking is easy. We do it all the time. We can have a conversation with other people. It's not very difficult. And talking in front of many people is the same as talking in front of one person. It's just that there are many others listening as well. In fact, one of the techniques of learning how to do public speaking is to speak to one person in the audience. To pick one person and speak to them. Excuse me. So you pick that one person and you would be like speaking to them and the others are eavesdropping on your talk with this one person. But somehow people can't do that because there's something else working there. There are fears behind it. What are these fears? Let's just take a hypothetical person and let's just examine the fears of that hypothetical person. And really, this is a person who I do not know if exists or doesn't exist. Just a theoretical person who has a fear of public speaking. And when you are doing something like EFT and you're trying to work through this fear, there's usually something behind it. What would be behind it in our hypothetical person? Let's say our hypothetical person is afraid of sounding foolish. Our hypothetical person is afraid of sounding foolish. Now just think about that. Okay, what is the basis of that fear? Why would one think they are going to sound foolish? Now, let's say our hypothetical person, if they were to come in contact with how they feel, if they were to all of a sudden feel that, well, my father, for example, in this hypothetical person, would think badly about what I would say. My hypothetical father, the hypothetical person, would think badly if I said something wrong, and I would be criticized. I would be looked down upon or disrespected for not expressing it properly or appropriately. Or if when this hypothetical person was a little boy or a little girl and would come out into the room and many people were there and would laugh or would make some little display, pleasurable display as children do, and was pushed out of the room, was told to be quiet, was told to not make a display. You can understand that there would be this feeling that coming in public or speaking in public would bring about this feeling of failure, of having done something wrong. So really what that person is doing when they feel this fear of public speaking is they have projected into their audience many of their fathers sitting there who would look at them and say, "You are talking foolishly. Just be quiet. You are not able to do this. You are not smart enough. You are not intelligent enough to speak in front of others." This type of analysis is very important. When you go down at the deeper levels in many activities that one does, you will find at the bottom of it there is a reason for why we do what we do, why we feel what we feel, why we react the way we do. Because we have experience. We have experience that has made us afraid or has made us feel suffocated in some sense, which has made us feel that we're not able to deal with the situation. And I find that amongst most people, lack of confidence is an extremely significant point. Lack of self-confidence. Even when you deal with people who are like really blown out of the universe with themselves. "I am so great. I am just fabulous and you stink." That means really puffed up and "I can do anything better than you. I am just the best at this." And when they are expressing like this, when they insist on putting you down while trying to put themselves up, it always, and I mean always, and I'll repeat that, it always is based on that person's having self-doubt, that person's having a lack of confidence, that person's need to use you as a means to climb higher. Because those who are good at what they do, those who know what they are doing, don't need to do that. I've been around really good musicians. I don't mean really famous people. Maybe also famous, but really superb musicians. People who don't have anything to prove to anybody. They don't have any desire to prove they're better than you musically. They just like friendship. And yet I've been around musicians who are kind of like, you know, okay. Not really spectacular. Because, you know, in music, just being able to play fast doesn't necessarily mean you play eloquently. Just like anybody can talk. Even people can talk really fast. Even somebody can talk a lot. Even somebody may talk with a lot of knowledge. They may not be eloquent. They may not be able to express things in a manner which make it easy for you to understand, which actually express what they are as people, and which actually has some beauty to it. Anybody can play fast. Anybody can play really technically very well. It's just a question of practice. I remember when I was in college and we used to share a bandstand with another band, and this guy used to play guitar. I remember what he looks like. I just forgot his name. And he had the capacity to play really fast. And I couldn't play like that. I mean, nothing I played was like that. So I said to him, I said, gee, you know, how do you do that? That's just so damn good. And he looked at me and he said, it's just finger exercises. They used to listen to what we played because it was, I don't know, nice to hear. And he thought of himself as finger exercises. I've been with such people who, not like that person, he was a little humble, but I've been with people who are kind of like, okay, but who don't have that eloquence. That eloquence of bringing others in to the conversation. We talked about this previously. The eloquence of sharing. Because if you think about it, those who have something to prove, those who need to step on you to bring themselves up, they don't know how to share because they use you to advance themselves. Therefore, they can't share with you. They use you. When you use others, you can't share. If you think about that parent who smothers the child, it's not really about the protection of the child. It is actually about the parent trying to increase their self-worth by proving what a responsible parent they are. What a super parent they are. And in this way, they are trying to prove to themselves that they are good, that they're worthy. And they're trying to increase their own confidence in themselves. If you look at each and every situation where you have a person who feels fear of something, or fear of someone, or some kind of, need, you will see behind it, there is something related to the way we were dealt with in the past. And if you look at that, you will see behind that is always this person who is tormented. Because a tormented person always torments others. It's in that form of misery loves company. When you are tormented, when you feel miserable, you like to bring others into it. Or you like to use others as a means to relieve yourself. You can even analyze many criminal type of personalities who justify their activities as a product of a reaction against the society in which they live. Society has given me this unfair situation, has caused me to not have opportunities, or has forced me into this situation. Therefore, society deserves whatever it is I might do. So there's usually at the bottom of most intense difficulties a tormented soul. Now, I'm not saying this is at the bottom of all difficulties, but it's at the bottom of the intense ones. Like when you feel suffocated, or you feel great fears, or you feel this tension from others, you will find at the bottom of this is a tormented soul. A person who is having an extraordinarily difficult time dealing with their lack of confidence, dealing with their self-doubt, dealing with their own internal pain. You will always find this is just the way life is. It's challenging us. And A balanced person is one who has self-confidence. I don't mean it in the sense of expressed self-confidence, that I can do anything, don't worry, you know, I'll handle this, and you just don't know nothing, that's okay, I'll take care of everything, it's just all... I don't mean like that. I mean in the sense where somebody says, I know what I can do, I know what I can't do, and I'll do what I can do as best I can. What I can't do, either I'll learn to do, or I'll find someone else to help, or I'll avoid it. Or if I have to do it anyway, it will be imperfect, but I'll do it the best I can. This is the key word. We do the best we can. Now, I know some people who are prejudiced or actually not very analytical in their minds have heard this statement, be the best you can be. And they say that's some kind of like new agey blah blah. But in reality, it is the opposite of the tormented soul. You will find many people who are in religious movements are actually tormented souls. They are there because there's something in them so tormented that they need this complete rejection of anything material, so-called, because these are the things which give them this reminder of that which torments them. And you know all that goes from that: lack of confidence, self-doubt, self-criticism, guilt, ad infinitum. But whereas a person who's got actual confidence is a person who knows, I shall do the best I can do in every situation that comes before me at every moment in time. That person doesn't suffocate others because they have nothing to prove. They're not tormented within. They don't need to create another person in a manner which will prove to themselves that they are good. They let people be and simply encourage them to be the best they can be. These are not small or insignificant concepts. To be the best you can be is a right down at the bottom fundamental axiomatic truth of the spirit. And that confidence that is so essential for all of us is based upon the fact that you have enough confidence in yourself that you know under any and all circumstances you're going to do the best you can do. And you know that if and when you do something which is less than that which you would want to do, you have the confidence that you'll adjust your life, adjust your consciousness, adjust your reaction to do the best you can do, to be the best you can be. And that means you allow mistakes. You allow imperfection to exist within you. And that you, instead of condemning yourself for the mistakes and imperfection, you use these as an impetus to develop, to conquer over, to work out, to grow beyond these mistakes and imperfection. The idea that you have to be perfect is the source of the tormented soul. Think about that. This idea that you have to be perfect is the cause of the torment of the soul. That's pretty significant. And when you just understand you are what you are, that's the cause of the healing of the soul. And the principle is to be the best you can be. At every moment in time, that next step forward, that next step, one step after the next. This idea of perfection pervades religion. All religion has this idea that you've got to be perfect. You are not now perfect. There's only one state, perfection and imperfection. You are now imperfect. That means you are bad. You are not good. You are not in that original state of perfection. You are sinful because you are either perfect or not perfect. Of course, if you start talking about more imperfect, or would it be the other way, less imperfect than other imperfect souls, you get into a very amusing situation. And in order to inspire the less than perfect souls, we choose one who we think is less imperfect and declare them as perfect, evolved, advanced, whatever you want to call it, but we expect perfection from them, because those who are more imperfect need to aim to the perfection. So they have to shoot their way through that perfect personality to get to the perfection. This is not just religion. It's also in the family when you are born. The mother and father are the perfect ones. Whatever mommy and daddy says is absolutely true. Whatever they do should be perfect. So when they do something strange or weird, we can't think they are less than perfect, so we think it's our fault. We're the cause of all the problems because they're perfect, so it must be us. This, I feel that you can boil down most of these aberrations in the psychology, aberrations in the heart, aberrations in the soul, to this feeling there must be perfection. We should be perfect. And those who we follow should be perfect. It is something which torments us, because we are not perfect. And this torments us. And the most difficult thing there is to do in the whole of our lives is to simply accept ourselves as we are and to simply accept others as they are without judgment. It's one of my nightmares that, you know, I was so happy when I could leave this environment I was in before, being the perfect guru. What a horrifying environment to be in. Suffocating me. Totally suffocating me with expectations. suffocating me with demands for this perfection, although it doesn't exist. And neither then, not only that, but it should not exist. Things just are. And that is fine. So when I left that environment, I felt such an enormous relief. I don't have to be perfect anymore. But then I wanted to share my experiences. So I started speaking. I started making these programs. I mean, we have been doing this particular form of broadcasting for more than 3 years. This public broadcasting and lectures have been going on all the time. And now I'm worried every time when I sit here before you, before I'm to give these discussions, that I have to be perfect again. I have to speak perfectly. It makes me feel tense, suffocated again. So before I gave this lecture, I was in the temple room, sitting in front of the deities. I was doing my EFT on this feeling of suffocation, this feeling of having to be perfect. Because I know what I am. I'm okay with this. You know what I mean? I'm okay with what I am. Are you okay with me as I am? What if what I said wasn't perfect? And what does it mean anyway, perfect? You know, I had a really interesting experience. We invited one ISKCON devotee guy for lunch, also lady. They didn't want to eat. You know why? Because we are blooped karmis again. Who knows what they do? Who knows what's hiding in their refrigerator? You know, because when you're around devotees, you have to hide all the time. You have to hide because everybody's looking. One of the most hysterical things I ever saw. One Swami came to visit us once. And as soon as he had a chance, he opened the refrigerator to see what was inside. It was hysterical. What was he looking for? I mean, like, and if he found something, would he run out of the house? I mean, it's like a hysteria. It all has to be like, you know, perfect. And you can't do anything a little different. I remember, you know, Upendra, who just died recently. He was with us in France. He helped us for a long time in our house, and he lived there for many months. And one day when he thought I was in a good mood, a pensive mood, thoughtful, we were alone, and he turned to me and he said, "You know, I tried fish." And then he was just quiet. I was just like shocked. I mean, not because of the fish, but because he told me. I wasn't sure whether it was a confession and I was supposed to say, "Dominion on something, you know, you are forgiven," and just say four Hail Marys. And I wasn't sure what I was supposed to do, or whether this was a sharing of a feeling of guilt, or if it was just a news that would be interesting, or I had no idea what was supposed to be my response. So I said, "Really? You ate it?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "What did it taste like?" He said, "Wasn't bad." I said, "Wow, okay." And we went on doing what we were doing. And I saw that he was like trying to figure out whether he became less in my eyes. Whether he became, or whether I saw him differently because he told me he ate fish. And I saw that later on, you know, he used to try all kinds of things. He was very open-minded in his experiences because he always was trying to find some meaning in life. So then he would just come every now and then to see me, and he would be observing whether I would judge him, whether I would condemn him for what he did. And honestly, I never did, so we always had like this kind of very light relationship, fun relationship. But I found that thing about the fish to be just really so revealing. Can you imagine normal people in the world? Can you imagine just people sitting around, you know, you and your neighbor, for instance, and your neighbor comes and tells you, I ate fish. What would you say? Would say like, yeah, you want some more? I don't know. What should I do? It's like an absurd thing to say. People just don't say things like this. But amongst us people who were suffocated with these expectations of perfection, this was like a mountain being spoken. A mountain of revelation was being revealed here. This fish now became bigger than a whale, and it was being placed on the floor in front of us. And we're all looking at this monstrous fish and contemplating it. He ate fish. It's just amusing. This expectation. And if when that Swami had looked in our refrigerator, if he had found a fish, or even worse, a meat, or I don't know what he was looking for, if he had found it, what would he have done? Go in the bathroom, stick his finger up his mouth, and throw up all the food? Excuse himself politely and walk out the door and never come back? Spend the rest of the afternoon being polite and smiling and trying to correct us from our ways? Well, he didn't find anything, so that means we're okay? Or does it mean that we had another refrigerator somewhere where we hide all the nasty stuff? Do we still think like this about each other? Does it matter to you what I have in my refrigerator? Think about that. In your mind, picture whatever terrible thing you want in my refrigerator. And then here I am talking to you. How do you feel about that? Picture a hot dog in my refrigerator. Picture me eating a hot dog with a can of beer, watching a baseball game on TV. Picture that. How does that make you feel about listening? Have you figured it out? Now, you may be thinking, yeah, he's just saying this. He doesn't really do that. He doesn't eat hot dogs. Well, how do you know? How do you know what I do? And if you only feel good about listening to me because you think I what? Follow four regulative principles? What do you really think about me? What do you really think about everyone else you meet? What do you demand of others before you listen to them? Is the demand actually that what I say has value to you? Or is the demand that the person saying it lives a certain way, acts a certain way? Think about that, and you will understand why we create gurus, why we create popes, why we encourage restrictions, because we demand that those who we supposedly, quote unquote, learn from to teach us how to be perfect are themselves perfect. Is that not the basis upon which the tormented soul torments others? In reality, it doesn't bother me if a person talking about spirituality eats hot dogs, drinks beer, or whatever. All that matters to me is if what they are giving me I find valuable and useful for my evolution, because it is my responsibility to evolve. It is my responsibility to accept that which makes sense to me. Let's take two examples. There's this one person over here who's a pure devotee and is telling me that unless I go to Mangal Artik, I will never go back to Godhead. And then there is this meat-eating, fornicating, karmi. Fornicating means they have sex. Who's telling me to be the best I can at every moment in time? Is it just the qualification of the person? Or is it the realization of the person? Okay, I may choose my personal friends in certain ways. I would not like to have criminals as my friends. I would not like to have violent people as my friends. I would not like to have drug addicts as my friends. I don't care if my friends do some stuff now and then, but if they are characterized in a certain way, I wouldn't like to be around them. But if they are friends and if they have these characteristics, not to the extreme, I don't mind. But when it comes to gaining spiritual knowledge, to gaining knowledge which is going to help me, there's only one qualification. Does this person know what they're talking about? And is what this person is talking about something I can use? And if that is so, I don't care what they eat. I don't care what they drink. I don't particularly care what they do, because I don't relate with them like that. And therefore, I don't have much trouble dealing with anybody, because I don't make demands on them like that. That doesn't mean I deal with everybody. But for those who I do deal with, I do not make such demands. For me, this whole exchange with Upendra is a delightful memory. Practically the innocence of this man to stand there and with all this seriousness say, I ate fish. And I really, really had to control laughter in one sense and control not trying to put on my robes and be the priest in the confession, to simply continue speaking as friends. It's the way I wish other people would deal with me. You know, all of this was inspired by somebody I just met who's an old friend for, my God, 36 years, and who's having a real hard time in his life. And I just found out about it suddenly, and I'm just like realizing that the hard time that person's having is because of his wife's expectations, his wife's demands on him for perfection. And it's like, are we people or not? Are we human or not? And therefore, that tormented soul he was married to has now decided with full force to torment him. And it just dawned on me, the tormented soul, the theme. This is the whole theme of this lecture. In fact, I hope I remember to call it so. The tormented soul. Let me write that down, because I have a memory of I'm tormented by bad memory here. The tormented soul. It's just a concept which is so fundamental to our spirituality. And it's that torment in you who would have a hard time thinking about me chewing on a hot dog. I think this is a very, very important thing. But I think we've also finished this discussion. It's just something that's so essential, so relevant, such a powerful force in our lives. I'm going to take questions today. So if you have any, you can send them over. I have one discussion here. And it's actually, these points have been brought up before, and you will always hear them whenever you have a discussion with others about this point, that don't take what I said to mean that you should not have goals in life, that you should not try to develop yourself. Just because you are what you are doesn't mean you stay what you are. If I am at a certain location in my spirituality, I should make the next step. I should make steps forward. Because after all, life is a movement. Life is a flow. Spirit is a flow. Spirit is an energy. So we have to take steps, one step after another, to move forward. Otherwise, we stagnate. We have to be moving. Our energy has to be flowing. Otherwise, we stagnate. So, just accepting yourself and accepting others does not mean that you shall stagnate. You shall not move forward. Let's say you have bad habits. Now, first of all, let's define what a bad habit is. It's something that either harms you or it's something you don't want to do. Let's say if while I'm talking, I always say and then So this is not harming me. If I speak and I say it doesn't harm me. It may drive you crazy, but actually it doesn't harm me. Smoking cigarettes, for instance, actually harms my health. It makes my aura gray. It reduces my capacity to breathe in oxygen, which reduces my brain capacity, ultimately can cause cancer. It's definitely not a good thing. But I asked in the beginning that we define bad habits. And cigarettes smoking would fall into the category of a self-destructive habit. Would that be considered bad? Well, it depends. Let's say I wanted to kill myself. Then if I thought smoking was a great way to do it, I would not consider it a bad habit. I would consider it a good habit because it was accomplishing this purpose. Now, obviously, that's useless. Obviously, that's ridiculous, because if you were honest about killing yourself, you would do it in some quick way. You wouldn't do it in this slow way. So this idea of, you know, you considering it a good habit because it's what you want to do is also not true. It's really what you are saying is I feel so bad about me and I just want to kill myself, but I'm too afraid to admit it. I'm totally chicken. I'm completely afraid. So I'll do it this kind of sneaky way and not talk about it. So now it would be better that you who had this desire, talked to somebody else and got some encouragement to be honest with yourself about what you're really doing or what you're trying to feel better about. For example, if we talk about people who smoke, sometimes people smoke because it keeps them from being angry, or it keeps them from being frustrated. And then you ask, well, why are you angry and frustrated? And then it might come down to the way their parents dealt with them, or the way they were cheated by somebody, or the way whatever. So there's always something behind it. So if you, for instance, are looking at somebody else who smokes, and you start condemning them because they smoke, or you don't want to have anything to do with them because they smoke, you miss an opportunity to render service to that person, to help them understand the truth of what it is that's happening in their life. Now, I don't mean when I say to feel good about yourself that you should therefore have all these self-destructive habits and feel good about them. Obviously, that's not my point. I can't even imagine how somebody could think it would be my point. But then again, somebody who insists on being perfect, insists on being just this best perfect person, would take anything I would say like this and say, but that means I have personal responsibility, not that, I mean, you've got to force me to be perfect. You've got to say things that make me be perfect. The idea being that if somebody is this feeling of intense desire to be perfect, and I'm saying things like, it doesn't matter if you're perfect or not, then that person gets upset because they want me to say, don't do this, don't do that, be perfect. And that would be contrary to what I've spoken about. After all, for example, if you're a musician, you don't need other people to inspire you to become better. You do it yourself. You know the way people react when you play. You don't need any other feedback than that. And if you think you play fine and you don't need to develop, great. Who am I to criticize? It's your choice whether you want to learn more or not. Some people just play music for fun. They don't care if you like it or not. They don't have to do it perfectly or not. That's okay. That's fine. So all of this stimulus to expand, all of this stimulus to develop, should come from within. It's your personal responsibility to develop. It's your personal responsibility to expand. I cannot force you to do it. I cannot create the situation by which you want to do it. I can simply offer assistance so that you understand what is stopping you from doing it. And that, I feel, is an important thing for me to do. Here's an interesting question which is very much related to this thing about the way people have to be spiritual or to be known as spiritual. Now, again, we have this example because one of our listeners is also very influenced by the power and the grace of this person, Bruno Gröning, who's one of the most powerful and significant healers that probably in modern times. And he always would say that it is not me who's doing anything, it is God. So let us just give thanks to God, connect to God, and so on. Now, at the same time, his personal life was not perfect. For example, he smoked cigarettes. Obviously, he ate anything and everything at the time in Germany. We're talking in the late 40s or whatever. So So it is not that we have here a person whose personal life was just so perfect in every way. According to one point of view. And yet we have a person who was so tightly connected with the Supreme that this incredible healing power flew through not only him, but through the whole atmosphere to heal people. Now, he didn't do it for money. He didn't do it for fame. And he accepted so much from people that he died very young. He didn't even take care of his health. So this is an example of a person who was very deeply connected with God, yet did not appear to be a perfect example of a vegetarian principle-following personality. How do you make sense out of this? I don't think we need to. I don't think it's our responsibility to judge the way people are. I don't think it's our responsibility to demand that somebody be a certain way before they're able to reflect the qualities of God. It would be just like us demanding God to choose representatives who seem to be perfect. What right do we have to tell God, this representative you have chosen is not up to the standard? Who's making this standard? Why do we make this standard? What is the point of what it is that we're thinking here? So this was the point of these people in Germany who are writing to me and saying that this is a perfect example of what I was talking about. And yes, it is. I could, of course, make the converse of this point. I could speak about people who seem to be just the perfect, absolute, all that, and aren't. But I think that would be counterproductive. Because it is us who make the decisions of how we perceive others. And we have our reasons for doing so. Okay, here's a comment which I'd like to share with you. All these issues surrounding eating and sex and so on are actually insignificant compared with the internal qualities of love, of sharing that love and taking care of others, of nonviolence to others, of well-wishing to others, which are the actual spiritual qualities that which are all surrounding and making up what is that spiritual love. So that is a very nice comment. Thank you for the comment. Actually, there was somebody, I forgot his name. Maybe it was, I don't remember. But he said, it's not what you put into your mouth that's significant. It's what comes out of it that's most significant. Isn't that interesting? I mean, after all, Hitler was a vegetarian. And I've seen really so-called spiritual people who really are strict in what they eat say the most horrifying things. Here's an unrelated question. It's exactly, I'm reading it. I am having my kirtan night tonight. This is somebody who runs a yoga center and is going to do kirtan in the yoga center in America here. I am having my kirtan night tonight and thinking of chanting to Shiva Parvati, that I've never done that before. What would be the meditation while chanting, since I never thought of a relationship to Shiva? People in yoga studios love Om Namah Shivaya. Well, you know, if you go onto harrymedia.net in the lectures section, and maybe it's on the first page or second page of the lectures, you have to go back, There's one lecture called Shiva Parvati Radhe Shyam. And I think if you really want a very deep and in-depth answer to that question, which was one of the most fun lectures I ever got to give, you can listen to that particular lecture, Shiva Parvati Radhe Shyam. And I think the relationship between Lord Shiva and Goddess Parvati and the way in which they relate with Radha and Krishna is a very sublime, supportive, complementary relationship. This whole idea that if you somehow have a connection to quote-unquote demigods, devas, especially Lord Shiva, that somehow or another you are less in the eyes of Radha and Krishna, or you are less of a devotee, or you are somehow contaminated, or somehow there will be something bad. It's all very silly. If you even look at Lord Chaitanya, he used to go to all of the, anyway, this is all in this lecture, you can hear it, but if you even know the history of Lord Chaitanya, he spoke with Lord Shiva. He visited the Shiva temples. I mean, these ideas of making this separation, this is a very materialistic concept, to separate. Lord Shiva and Goddess Parvati do not feel at any moment separate from Radha and Krishna. But it's us who make the separation. Somehow, this is the supreme, and these are somehow contaminated. I know there are even Vaishnavas, so-called, who are so very advanced, I don't deny it, I don't doubt it, who feel that in actuality, because Lord Shiva is connected with the material world, because he's the Lord of Tamaguna, whatever that means, he is somehow contaminated. I feel sorry for them when they say like that. I feel sorry for people who don't get the opportunity to experience the very beautiful, loving, supportive, and very integrated energy of Lord Shiva, Mother Parvati. Very integrated energy. Their energies are integrated throughout this whole universe. This whole universe rests upon their integrated energies. And their energies are very intensely integrated with us if we just open ourselves to that integration. And making this separation is not advantageous for our spiritual development. It limits us needlessly. It prevents us from having an absolutely fabulous, deep, and intense experience here in this world that is so connected to Radha and Krishna. Because Lord Shiva, Goddess Parvati are so connected. They are expansions of the Supreme. Intimately connected. Anyway, you get the point. So I think when you do that chanting tonight at your kirtan, if you think about that integration, that concept of integration, the way in which the energies of Radha and Krishna, don't make a mistake, the energies of Radha and Krishna are integrating through Lord Shiva and Goddess Parvati in this whole universe. And when you place yourself within that integrated energy, you will see things totally differently. That's my answer to that. Okay, here is a comment. I think that what you've said today is kind of radical. Many people can argue that what you eat has a direct effect on what you say. That's not the whole comment, but I'm going to stop there for a second. Let's assume this is correct, that what you eat has a direct effect on what you say, then why is it that some of the nastiest things I've ever heard in my life have come from people who eat prasadam? How do you answer that? So I'll leave you with that. Now I'll go on. And I know, I'm reading the question again, and I know that you eat only certain things. Oh, you mean me. And you are personally very sensitive to what you eat. I think you would not reject this argument. Am I right? Yeah, now you're sticking me in the middle of this. Now it's no longer a philosophical discussion. We have to talk about me and what I eat. Good grief, that's really a horrible situation. But anyway, I eat what I eat and I don't eat what I don't eat, not because I'm afraid of what I'm going to say. I do that because I'm afraid of the reaction in my body. I'm sensitive in the body. And therefore, I'm careful from my health point of view. Because I'm not, shall we say, strong enough to just eat anything and everything's fine. I have these problems that have to be dealt with proper diet and doing things properly. So it's not specifically related to what I'm saying. Although naturally, if I were to sit here and drink a whole bottle of wine or whiskey, I would really tell you something, I tell you. Naturally, there would be an effect. But I don't think that's what you meant. But anyway, thank you for the question so I have a chance to do my comedy routines.